Accession number 30082, Reel 1.
Major Geoffrey Fletcher, Reel 1.
One of my earliest recollections, when I must have been about 9 or 10, was of my father taking me down to the works, as we called it, his business, which was a manufacturing business mainly in those days, of sprayers for hops and for fruit. And my mother, who was a great sportswoman, she captained Kent Ladies at golf, off a handicap of one, and she hit a tennis ball like a man. She had gone off to play golf, so I was going to the works with father to keep me quiet. And he always left at 7:30 in the morning and said, be at the car at 7:30, old man. And I must have been a minute or two late, because he was looking at his watch when I arrived, and he said, you realize you're 2 minutes late, old man. I said, well, I hadn't, father, I'm so sorry. He said, a tip, if I may. He was a loving and lovely man. A tip, if I may, old man, he said, and what a lovely way to address a 10-year-old. He said that one of the principal marks of a gentleman is consideration for others, and that includes never keeping anybody waiting. I'd been sent to a prep school near Hyde, the headmaster of which was a major chaplain, major from the First War, of course. And when I was about 11, my father went to see the headmaster with me in tow and said, headmaster, I was at the Maidstone Grammar School and I know nothing about public schools. Where would you recommend for Geoffrey? Major General, Major Chappell said, well, Colonel Fletcher, we like your little boy very much. He's kind to smaller boys, but I have to say that he's rather wet, and I would recommend a school that is going to toughen him up for the world that lays ahead of him. And therefore, I propose Repton in the Midlands. And I'll get the colour sergeant, who comes over from Shorncliffe Barracks every Thursday to give the boys PT, I'll get him to give Geoffrey boxing lessons, so that when he gets strapped in, he can stand up for himself. And that will be an extra pound a term. So I had 2 years individual boxing lessons. And I happened to have a long reach as well. And when I arrived at Repton, the head of the house, a rough Yorkshire, tough Yorkshireman called J.D. Thwaites, said, well, Fletcher, what games do you play? And I said, well, I play hockey and cricket and football, but I'm not very good at any of them. And he said, good God, boy, you must be good at something. I said, well, I think I box a little bit. And he said, right, we'll find out about that this evening. And that evening he got another boy, who was a bit bigger than me, quite a bit bigger, to come down to the dining hall. We cleared a few tables, and we were put to box each other. Well, he couldn't box, really, and I could. And I gave him a bloody nose. And the result was that I found myself in the Repton boxing team, the captain of which was a fellow called Roald Dahl, who later became a famous author. And in each of the 4 years that I was at Repton, I moved up a weight. And in my final year, at the age of 17, I actually won the Repton School Boxing Cup, which sits in my cupboard at home to this day. The point about boxing is that if you lose, you get hurt. Bloody nose, bruises, whatever. And it gives you a singular determination to win, more than any other sport or activity that I know of. And that determination to win stood me in marvelous stead through life, in the army, in business, and even in games. Another very strong movement at Repton was the OTC, the Officers Training Corps. Every boy had to join the corps, and we were trained in drill, map reading, compass reading, weapon training and shooting, route marches, and every year the whole corps went to CAP together with other schools under army supervision. And one mildly amusing incident was that if you happened to get caught by another school, you were automatically debagged and sent home without your trousers. It meant after 4 years in the OTC that one already had quite a lot of military experience and training. And I think I finished up as a corporal. I think that's all of that. I could deal just briefly with my 2 years as I was planning to go into the family business in due course. It was agreed with my father that I would spend 5 years articled as a chartered accountant in the city, and had digs in London, and that started in September 1937. In those days there were 9 stations between South Kensington, Gloucester Road, and Cannon Street in the city, and the fare was 4D, 2.5p, from my digs to the city, and a 2-course lunch in Warbrook, opposite Cannon Street Station, was exactly 1 3, with a 2D tip for the waiter. I'd always been keen on the idea of the army, and I joined the Territorial Army on my 18th birthday in April 1938. Having acquired Certificate A at school, even then war looked highly likely, and it was a lucky move. It gave me a head start when war came, and we were embodied into the regular army in September the 1st, 1939. I became a captain and platoon commander soon afterwards in the RASC of 4-4 Infantry Division. My platoon was responsible for delivering ammunition to forward units, infantry, gunners, etc. In those days, 18-pounders, 2-inch and 3-inch mortars, Vickers and Lewis machine guns, 303 rifles, etc. We were shipped to France in February 1940. Up to then, hardly a shot had been fired by either side. Germans opened their Blitzkrieg on May the 10th and overran the British and French armies in 3 weeks. They were vastly superior in every department. Their generals, their leadership, their highly professional army and tactics, their armaments. For example, our soldiers mainly still had First World War Lee Enfield 303 rifles, 10 rounds a minute if you were good. They all had automatic weapons, firing 60 rounds per minute or more. So the British Army was ordered to retreat to Dunkirk, where it was hoped some may get away to fight another day. In the meanwhile, my platoon was manning an AP, an ammunition point, in a forward area, when a convoy of German tanks swept through, firing briefly as we all dived into ditches. Luckily, only two of my soldiers were killed and two or three wounded. I was lucky. A bullet hit my tin hat and glanced off. When I took it off to inspect it, there was quite a groove, and I could even see a speck of daylight when I looked at it from inside. The roads to Dunkirk were solid with the debris of a retreating army, destroyed guns and vehicles, disabled tanks, etc. We had to walk the last 7 or 8 miles to the beach, and though a sunny, warm day, we were advised to carry greatcoats in the high expectation that we would become POWs. It was on May the 30th and the evacuation was in full swing from the pier at Dunkirk and from the sandy beaches a couple of miles to the north where we had been directed. We all still carried our personal arms, but that was all. The beach was an amazing sight, as thousands of pretty shaken soldiers, still mostly in their units, sat on the sand in hopes. By now, a brilliant Admiral Ramsay at Dover had organized a fleet of ships to ferry us home, upwards of 250,000 of us. A few naval destroyers, tugs, small cargo ships, pleasure steamers, yachts sailed by their owners, which could take up to a dozen. No big ships, as they could never get in close enough in the shallow waters, and in any case would certainly have been sunk by the steady stream of Heinkel dive bombers. The German bombers concentrated on the ships rather than the beaches, although now and again one would take a run along the beach with their machine guns blazing. We fired back, but in our 2.5 days on the beach, I only saw 2 German planes brought down into the sea to a huge cheer. It was on our second day on the beach that a French destroyer had been bombed and was on fire about 1/2 mile out to sea, when suddenly, out of the calm sea, a huge metal cylinder roared up the beach with a loud whirring noise and finished just 2 yards from where Maurice Morling, who happened to be a cousin, and I were sitting with our platoons. Without moving, we could almost touch it, about 2 feet in diameter and 12 feet long. You may think that a rather obvious thing to do was to jump up and run for our lives. But surely, this was yet another of Hitler's frightening, death-dealing devices. But to a man, we had been so traumatized by our total defeat by the German army's superiority in weapons and tactics and leadership that we were literally paralyzed by fear of this new, unknown terror weapon as we lay flat and waited for it to explode and blow us to kingdom come. This must sound pretty feeble and wet, and I still wonder at our paralysis. I can only say that it was what we had been reduced to. A few seconds later, the whirring stopped, and we realized that it was a torpedo, no doubt discarded by the French destroyer, so that it would not blow up the burning ship. It was not fused and did not blow up. It was at this point that an idea by the War Office raised our morale no end. Four or five Grenadier Guards captains in their service dress uniforms, gold braided caps, boots and Sam Brown belts shining, strolled along the beach, spoke to every group. "It's okay, gentlemen, we're going to get you off in the next couple of days." The calm certainty was hugely inspiring. About the same time, German Heinkel, instead of dropping bombs or machine gunning, circled overhead, dropping thousands of leaflets, which read, badly misspelled, "British soldiers, Germans around, you are encircled. German troops invaded Courtrai, Tournai, Valenciennes, Lillers, Ayr, Saint-Omer, and occupied Calais, will be taken immediately. Why do you fight further? Do you really believe this nonsense that Germans kill their prisoners? Come and see yourselves for the contrary. The match is finished. A fair enemy will be fairly treated." By now, we had long finished the contents of our water bottles and had nothing to eat for 2 days. Despite the resistance of our forces holding the edge of our perimeter, the German advance was now close and shell fire was reaching the beach. That night, about 10 p.m., our beach marshal said, "Your turn, chaps. Wade out to that old tramp steamer." About 100 yards out and up to our necks were three small boats, amateur yachtsmen from England. They heaved us aboard and delivered us to the rope ladders hanging down the rusty side of our steamer, then went back for more, but waded out as far as they could. We lay on the hold and on deck, maybe 300 of us or slightly more. Then, about midnight, we heard the throb of the ship's engines. Our relief was beyond description. The evacuation was abandoned the very next day as the Germans arrived. An hour out, about 8 miles, we were woken by a sudden silence. The engines had broken down. At first light, we would be sitting ducks for the Stukas. Then a man in filthy overalls and a strong Scottish accent appeared. "Don't worry, lads. I am the fucking engineer and I'll fix the old fucker before daytime." I think we were hugely reassured by his confidence. But so it proved. About 5 a.m., the throb had started again, and at 10 a.m., we hove to in Ramsgate Harbour, where 20 or more wonderful ladies served us cups of tea. That sight of the white cliffs has moved me ever since. We all still carried our rifles or revolvers, otherwise only what we stood up in. We were put on a train which was to take us to Stockport in Lancashire, where the division was to be reformed and rearmed. We all slept soundly until the train suddenly shuddered to a halt. I looked out of the window. We were in a small country station, and there was the name Adelstrop. It was only 2.5 years since I had left school, and I was touched with emotion. I hope it was not showing off, as I recited to the dozen of us crowded into that carriage. Yes, I remember Adelstrop, the name, because one afternoon of heat the express train drew up there unwontedly. It was late June. The steam hissed, someone cleared his throat. No one left, and no one came on the bare platform. What I saw was Adelstrop, only the name. Luckily, I've just got the end of that verse, so that's fitting well. Tell me. It was, at the time, a very moving moment. Right, are you ready? Okay. And for that minute, a blackbird sang close by, and round him, mistier, farther and farther, all the birds of Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire. I can only say that when I finished, there was hardly a dry eye in the carriage. We were home. After a period of re-equipping, our division was posted down to Kent to join a corps commanded by a general called Montgomery. The whole nation was expecting an invasion by air and sea by the powerful German army, and Kent, across the narrow channel, was the expected area for them to arrive. In August of 1940, the general ordered every officer in his corps to attend at the Granada Cinema Maidstone, which held some 1,500 people. It's true to say that after our experience, we were all set to die defending our country, but had little hope that we would succeed. The general appeared on stage and spoke for 75 minutes without a note on how we would defeat the Hun if he dared to come. He concluded, "We can only hope he tries, so that we, you and I, can give him the bloodiest nose of all time. We are here to defend our native land, and defend it we shall. I expect every soldier in my corps to kill at least one German every day, and that includes the Padres, two on Sundays." General Montgomery brought the house down. Our Air Force and Navy saw to it that the Germans never came. But is it any wonder that a year later, when General Montgomery was posted to command our army in the Western Desert, which had suffered innumerable setbacks, we all said, "That will fix the North African job." And so it did. We emerged from the Granada cinema in that summer of 1940, hoping the Hun would come and give us a crack. Such is the power of great leadership. The 34th Armored Brigade was an independent brigade of 180 Churchill tanks and three regiments, plus RASC, REMI, signals, ordnance, field ambulance. Each 40-ton tank used 3 gallons of petrol per mile, and the whole brigade 1,000 gallons per mile. The brigade strength was about 3,000 soldiers. I commanded the RASC company, responsible for ensuring that all units in the brigade were supplied with ammunition, petrol, and rations at all times, and for the locating and defense of the other supporting arms listed above. For this purpose, I had 516 soldiers in my company, which included 8 captains and 8 subalterns. Over 200 vehicles, mainly 3 and 6 tonners, with big tires for rough ground. A complete workshop, anti-tank weapons and machine guns for defense or use against low-flying aircraft, such as the Stuka dive bomber, and anti-gas protection suits and gas masks and radios effective up to 20 miles. In addition to my responsibilities to the brigade, I must add the welfare, training, and discipline of my soldiers. 6 weeks previously, I had enjoyed my 24th birthday. Though when I joined the brigade, I was first posted there to this exceptionally big job, I was still 22. Our brigadier was a fire-eating regular soldier with over 20 years' service. "Well, Fletch," he said, "you look bloody young to have such a huge responsibility for my brigade. If you cock it up, you'll be out the same week. Make it work, and you'll have my total support, come hell or high water." The wording he wrote on the citation from my MBE, presented to me in the field 2 years later, in March 1944, when I was still 24, was, I thought, more than generous. Now, those of us who have now been a member of the Order of the British Empire for over 63 years must be getting a bit thin on the ground. The invasion of Normandy in June 1944. Hitler had made the almost unbelievable error of invading Russia 3 years earlier. But the vast distances, bitter winters, and almost inexhaustible manpower meant that the German advance was halted just short of 1,000 miles, and that some 3/4 of the German army was still engaged on the Eastern Front, leaving only about 1/4 to face our invasion across the Channel, or it would have been out of the question. We would still have won the war, as 4 years of huge effort by thousands of scientists came up with the atom bomb in the late summer of 1945. But in June 1944, that was by no means certain. We'll be overriding it, won't we? The Germans expected our invasion in the Calais-Boulogne area, where the channel is only 20 miles wide, and had concentrated their main forces there. Together with the Americans, our planners had settled for Normandy and the Cherbourg Peninsula, where the beaches were more suitable, and hopefully the defences less concentrated. We now had air and sea superiority to guard our armada crossing and recrossing with the initial invasion and follow-up forces. Hundreds of boats had been built, mainly in America, basically LSIs, landing ship infantry, which could carry up to about 40 soldiers. Flat-bottomed, could drive up the shallow beaches before letting the armored ramp down, so that the soldiers only had to jump into about 2 feet of water before charging across the beach in the face of enemy fire. LSTs, landing ships tech, not too different, but smaller than our present cross-channel ferries. Each could hold up to almost 100 tanks or trucks, but ran aground in 4 feet of water, so every vehicle had to be waterproofed for the drive down the ramps. This was done with a material like plasticine. All sensitive parts had to be covered, carburetors, plugs, distributors, etc., and exhaust pipes extended to above 4 feet. Special concrete dips 4 feet deep were built so that every tank and vehicle could be tested before the great day. No doubt some still exist in places like Watershare Park in Kent. 34th Armoured Brigade was due to land on D+14, but on that day a huge storm blew up in the channel, which put a stop to all landings for 2 days.